Dr. Dan Siegel, thank you so much for making time to speak to us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, a pleasure.
And I know you've done just so much work over the years on understanding the way our system, our mind, brain, and body system works together. Would you please just start by giving us a brief overview of the way that brain integration affects our well-being and function?
Yeah, you know, what's been fascinating to me as a person just on the planet and someone professionally who works with people is to try to really hone in on what we can imagine the mind to be and then to think about what a healthy mind is. And in that journey, what arose was seeing the mind as not only subjective experience, which is the inner texture of lived life, and consciousness, this way we have a sense of knowing, but also a self-organizing process. This is a long line of reasoning I've published in a number of different books, but the take-home message is it's this self-organizing process that is arising as energy and information flows both within us and between us. And as it arises, it turns back and regulates itself. So it's an embodied and relational process that regulates energy and information flow. And when you see the mind that way and look deeply into self-organization, what you uncover is the idea that the linkage of differentiated parts, the taking of separate aspects of a system, like the left side and the right side of the brain, or two people in a relationship, and then allowing them to be honored for their differences, but then promoting compassionate linkages in a relationship or promoting connections across the brain, this results in the optimal kind of self-organization where it's a flexible, fluid flow of the system across time that creates what you can call harmony. And in the harmony are these features of it being flexible and adaptive. It has this quality in mathematics we call coherent. It sticks together well over time. And it's also really emerging with energy and stability. This spells the word faces, and that's our definition in the field I work in, interpersonal neurobiology, of health. So integration, whether it's within you in your nervous system or your whole body, or between you, your connection with other people, with the planet, with all sorts of things. Integration we see as the basis of well-being.
How would you consider the relationship between integration, brain integration, and creativity?
Well, I think, and this is now drawing on a lot of different lines of reasoning, I think that the creative experience that people have both in the day-to-day life of making the ordinary extraordinary, in just appreciating the fact we're alive, that we're awake, that we're aware, that we have each other, that we live on this magnificent planet, that's a kind of creativity with a, if you want to put a small C to it, you know, a way of living creatively. That comes from integration. That comes from really floating with the reality of our differentiated nature and then linking deeply to it. So integration for the small C kind of creativity is embedded in it. And for the more maybe midline C, if you want to call it that, of saying, you know, I'm going to write a novel, or I'm going to write a creative nonfiction book, or I'm going to paint a painting or sculpt a sculpting, or, you know, I'm going to make a garden, or I'm going to intentionally take an idea and turn it into a reality in a song. I'm going to write a poem. All these acts of, you know, creativity that may not get sold, or you may not make your living that way. That's like with a capital C, and that's a different kind of thing. But this middle C kind of creativity where you're intentionally trying to innovate and take some elements and put them in new combinations, take some ideas and turn them into transformations of reality. This kind of middle C activity is really something that also comes from integration, that it's a process of enabling you to embrace uncertainty and push things to the edge of chaos enough where they don't become overwhelming and flooded, because then this creative process just turns into nothing, and they don't become too depleted. completed, where you just create the same thing you've been dealing with forever, and it isn't really innovation, it's just repetition. This midline flow between chaos on the one hand and rigidity, the sameness on the other, is in fact the flow of integration. And so in innovation, I believe it comes from integration. And there are ways of thinking about that in the brain, there's ways of thinking about that in relationships, but the overarching response I would say to you is that integration creates this. Now, if you're talking about creation, you know, where someone was able to achieve some notoriety and fame and money and, you know, power because they created something, that may emerge from the middle C kind of creativity and even the small case C, these different layers of creativity. But that, you know, if you believe the work of Mike Csikszentmihalyi, you know, he sees this kind of capital C kind of creativity as not just arising from the flow of being lost in something, which is also a kind of integrative process, but rather it's a very special confluence of luck, you know, timing, situational things in the culture and what you have to offer. And so people who don't make it professionally, like, you know, for example, Van Gogh, you know, didn't make it when he was alive. You shouldn't despair that your efforts haven't been recognized. I mean, you can despair if you want to, but it isn't necessarily a sign of your effort or your talent or, in fact, the innovative nature of what you're doing, because so much more goes into the idea of, you know, being financially successful and recognized. I mean, I see this all the time in Hollywood here in Los Angeles, where people are writing all the time, and their writing is great, but, you know, the conditions didn't all fall into place, and sheer good fortune and luck, you know, influenced that more than these other two C's.
Yeah. Oh, that's so fascinating, and I'd really like to a bit later in our conversation, talk to you about the differences, you know, what's going on in your own system when you are appreciating your creative output for its own sake, as opposed to being really concerned about that external evaluation and the external recognition of the quality of your work.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really important question. I know, you know, for myself, in the nonfiction work that I do, I think that the point you're raising is just a starting place of making sure that the editor in me is a different role than the writer, and that I have to give myself permission to get in touch with a feeling in my body that is kind of like a an energy that is arising that's beyond my control. And in many ways, I know the first time this happened, I felt kind of bizarre because I had never had an experience like this. And it just started happening where, you know, I'd wake up at 4 a.m. with these ideas, and I'd have to get to the typewriter, and, you know, 4 hours later I would stop, and out come this stuff that I had no idea where it was coming from. In my conscious intentions, I knew I wanted to write something, but it was almost like it was being written through me, not by me. And I learned over time to really respect that feeling, not so much in a magical way, but, you know, to really respect that the process of integration, of allowing different elements to be differentiated and then linked, that's the definition of integration. That process has everything to do with embracing uncertainty. And that if your editor in you, or the part of you, maybe it's not so much the editor, but similar, the part of you that's worried, is this novel I'm writing going to be, you know, the great novel? Is this going to be a big hit? Is this going to make some bestseller list? You know, you already are interfering because you are concerning the focus of your attention with the outcome, not immersing yourself in the process. And what that does is it contaminates the way everything's unfolding. Now, you can say, well, Dan, we totally disagree. People say, and I've heard a little bit about this, but I haven't seen it directly, so I'm just, this is hearsay, but people say that the Beatles had in mind that they wanted to be a huge hit. And so they tried to figure out how to be a huge hit. Now, while that might be true with setting the course of what they did with their manager and their presentation, you know, I personally would love to know how the creative process especially went between John and Paul to give themselves into a song emerging. You know, so maybe they didn't do 25-minute songs because you never play them on the radio, but I can't imagine the very process of writing it. It wasn't this kind of honoring each other's differences as two songwriters and letting the linkages happen and then giving in to the power of uncertainty, which is where the integrative process really arises from, is really embracing uncertainty.
Oh, look, there's just so much in there. It's wonderful. In hearing what you have just said, I have had my own little aha, and that is that in the work that I do with fiction writers, this is so often the very, very problem that is most commonly presented, and that is of dealing with that critic. And the process that we have worked on, I now call first draft, first aid, where the very first step is to really clearly identify the stage of writing and really, in a really focused and intentional way, to delineate that stage and from the subsequent stages, and then set up a whole range of almost like characters and roles, and you know, like I said, a purpose for each stage and even a job description for the writer at each stage that is accompanied by a mindset, a mood, a sort of an identity, a whole set of rules. So they might actually even create just a whole system for themselves as writer at a particular stage. And separating that, just defining and understanding and even appreciating, deeply appreciating the role of the critic, but saying to that critic, look, you know, your time will come, and when that time's come, you'll be incredibly welcome here. So thank you, because
nice.
I have just understood that process for the first time in terms of differentiation. Could you please explain then a little of what you understand the vital function of differentiation to be? Because there's a paradox, isn't there, you know, that in order to have integration, firstly we must differentiate the different parts and different elements.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, well, you know, I think let's take a fiction writing, for example. A dear friend of mine is a fiction writer, and I can tell you from his experience, because I don't myself write fiction. I think we each have different things we can do, and I know that's not something I can do, or at least that's a thing I say to myself. And so far, I think it's probably true. You know, I think there's a, in his experience, I think there's a beautiful way he lets the characters live inside of him and lets them differentiate from him as a person, from him as a writer even. And, you know, I think Albee, I once heard him speak about his playwriting. It was the same kind of thing that my friend describes, you know, this idea that, you know, for fiction, the story, you know, we have this long, long history of being narrative creatures. You know, we have at least 40,000 years where we have documentation that, you know, we were painting things on cave walls, you know, that we are a storytelling creature, and all the cultures that have ever been studied of human beings, you know, have storytelling as, you know, a primary way that we communicate with each other. And even when you study something as sort of cognitive, if you will, as memory functioning, you know, when we embed facts in a story, they're easily accessed in retrieval of memory compared to just, let's say, listing those same facts. So, you know, there's every reason to believe that we have a long evolutionary history of being story receivers and story creators, and that stories are what unite us. So I particularly became very fascinated with stories in general. There's the work I do in attachment shows that the narrative that you have about your own early life experience is something that, you know, is the best predictor of how your children will do. And it got me to write a book called The Developing Mind, which was basically a story about how to understand this amazing fact that the coherence of your story was the best predictor of your children's developmental outcome in terms of their attachment, and that predicted all sorts of positive things. So I became fascinated with that, and my close friend being a fiction writer, I was just fascinated with that. And then I, as a psychotherapist, I thought, you know, basically it's what you do in psychotherapy is you help people make sense of their lives. And then when I looked into the brain aspects of it, it came to be clear that making a story coherent is an act of integration. And so part of, I think, what my friend does and Albie was doing, or the way I heard it anyway, was to allow this differentiation to occur within you, and the character starts to have a life of its own. We have these, I call them mindsight map-making areas. Mindsight is the ability to have insight and empathy and also integration. And so these areas of the brain that, let's say you have a character named Josefina, you know, your mindsight maps of Josefina need to be differentiated from your maps of yourself, that she gets a life of its own. And the people I work with who are actors, you know, when we talk, you know, about the relationship of their actual life to their acting life, you know, this comes up a lot of how do you embrace the whole mind, patterns of feeling and thinking and remembering, ways of interacting with other people, the mind of the character you're going to portray. Now, in this case, they're following a script. For the writers I work with and my friend who's a writer, you know, it's the same kind of thing that you have to give into the uncertainty, and here we come to uncertainty again, that there's a process beyond your control, and you have to give it permission so that this character comes alive in you. And not to kind of repeat a word, I think it's used an awful lot, but I think it's a great word. There's an authentic development of that character that isn't forced. It isn't constrained. It isn't, you know, it's not fitting into some caricature of what you think someone should be. And it's kind of like a book I once did called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, where, you know, Betty Edwards wrote this beautiful book. And you know, the issue was when most of us draw, we draw what we think something is supposed to look like, not what we're actually seeing. And the same way, I don't know if there's such a book, but there should be something like Writing on the Right Side of the Brain or something, where you let a character find her own voice, you let him find his own way, and you get out of the way. And that's a certain kind of integrative capacity to embrace uncertainty and sort of, I know this sounds strange, but kind of acknowledge that you're actually not the writer. You're more like the transcriber, you know? At least for me, that's how writing is I have to just say, you know, I'm just in service of this book. This book has an authentic wholeness to it that I would never be able to truly articulate. The book is going to articulate itself through me if I get out of its way. And, you know, in the 8 books I've written, I think that they always start with, except the one that I edited, which would be a 9th book, but in the editing it was a little different because the thing existed and I just had to update the references. But in the writing of it, there's a quality of, I don't know, almost having a relationship, a differentiated relationship with the book. And then when ultimately the book comes out, it's almost like I'm just a spokesperson for the book. I'm not the writer of the book. The book is going to use me to let people know about it. I mean, I just had a book called Brainstorm come out, and that's totally how it feels. I mean, this book was the hardest book I ever wrote, and, you know, it's just using me to get the word out about it.
You know, there are just so many really fascinating paradoxes in what you're saying here, Dan. And the one that I hear then is by differentiating yourself from the work, by letting yourself be the almost the conduit through which the work arrives on the page, you allow that freedom and the authenticity of the character development and the story development. The paradox I see again and again too is that through getting yourself out of the way, you are best placed to find your true voice and express that truly creative sort of core that only you will have.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I totally agree with the feeling behind what you're saying. I might modify the wording a little bit, if I might.
Yeah.
It'd be something like, it'd be exactly what you said, but I would take the word your true voice, and for a fiction writer, I would say the character's true voice.
Yeah.
And I would say something like, for a nonfiction writer, something like that the book's true voice or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but well, yeah, and I really take that point. And so I guess that what I'm thinking is that it's, in terms of your core creative, what you have to offer, I guess. That's probably what I was trying to say. So the uncensored expression of what you have in you to put out to the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, you know, it is a paradox. I love the way you're saying that because, you know, it's almost like, and I for myself, well, maybe you're about to say something. I'm interfering with what you're saying.
No, I'm hanging on every word.
Oh, okay. Because I get really excited about these ideas. And, you know, it's
so
almost like, it's so interesting to talk about this with you because it's almost like, you know, there's a phrase I use, and maybe it's my own personal little phrase, but like I think of it as relational writing, and I think of it as like sometimes I just let the book try to have a relationship with the imagined reader, and I'm kind of the scribe of that, and then other times I try to, and maybe this is not so different, but I try to actively think about the reader's experience. So if something is being written about, I don't know, the brain or about some story or about something going on with somebody or whatever, I mean, I'm always imagining a person sitting on a couch reading the book or, you know, walking their dog, listening to the book on tape or, you know, that I've recorded or something. Or, you know, I try to picture the receiver of it. And in doing that, I feel that the book's finding its voice and finding its way into, I mean, after all, you know, even if it's a nonfiction book, it's ideas being turned into substance. I mean, this is going to be something typed out on some pages, you know, and it becomes this strange permanence to it. So it's got to have a certain kind of, I don't even know what the word is. Like, I'm going to say a word that's too, like, haughty, but it's got to have a certain universality to it. It's got to have a certain, like, if the words are going to be on the page, they got to really relate to the reader in this universal kind of way. It can't be just a peculiarity of how I felt at that moment as the person typing. That they deserve those words deserve a kind of a deeper respect or a fuller consideration, or I don't even know what to say. So and then to do that, to develop that further consideration and that effort to honor their universality, so that as they exist in this undynamic way, that is, they're just words on a squash tree, you know, or else they're digital words on a screen, you know, there's a kind of, I don't know, maybe it comes from my relationship with this wonderful, wonderful man who sadly died 6 years ago, John O'Donohue. You know, John was an Irish Catholic priest and poet and mystic and philosopher, and he and I met each other years ago, and we began teaching together, and we were writing a book together. And so I really became inspired by him, and as a poet, he's a poet. I used to say, look, you know, words are symbols of something other than what they are. You know, like the word, you know, horse it's the symbol for the animal. He goes, yeah, well, that's sort of true for prose. He said, poetry is more where the word itself is the structure. It's not a symbol; it is itself. So it's not that I write poetry, because I don't, but I try to treat at least with some kind of, you know, attitude of hopefulness and intent, that the words will have that kind of respect for John. You know, that that they will, that they're more than just some idle cognition in your brain at the time that you were having your fingers on the typewriter. That there's something about them that has a fuller quality than just the temporary nature of how we think. Something like that.
And, I mean, you know, I can hear there the challenge of trying to express in words even this extra layer, the substance that you try to imbue your writing with in honor of John. How, just stepping back from it and thinking about the effect of that intention from you, what difference would you say, what is the quality that that adds? You know, what is it that is the end result of having that perception as you're writing?
Well, I think, you know, and I think this is, I think this has something to do with the, so fun and challenging to put words to this stuff, which I haven't really done before. It's so, you know, I think it's so, it's really, really, I think, important to have this kind of vision, and I don't even know if I can put words to it, but it's like you set an intention, like words will have a certain universality to them, or the book needs to find its own voice, I have to get out of the way, or this is a relational writing unfolding, which is really more about the reader and the book, and maybe me if I'm in the, if I'm a character in the story, which sometimes I am. So that intention sort of sets the direction of the uncertainty. That is, once you sort of set the intention, it's like a vector in physics, you know, it's going to set a direction, but then you get out of the way, and you let the uncertainty, that is, you're not control. When I say uncertainty, I mean you're not controlling it, you're not in charge, you are actually not really the writer, you're the transcriber of a process that you don't have to be, you know, have your hands all over. You can let it just happen in you, you can give it permission to emerge rather than make an outline of how it has to be or structure its form. You can set the intention of relationality and universality, then you can take a step back, set the arrow of intention, and let the freedom of uncertainty allow everything to unfold. And this is, you know, and then of course you just let that happen. Editing is a whole different thing we can talk about, but this is the writerly, you know, this is the writing state of mind, at least for me. And when John and I would write together, it's what we would do together. We would never try to edit when we were interacting with each other and one of us was typing. It was a, it was more saying, let's see this, how this goes, because you got to let the inside out. I mean, that's the thing. And you can't, when I say can't, of course, anyone can do anything, but I mean, it's best not to try to be editing while you're giving permission for the uncertainty of writing to be given respect and space.
Oh, look, there's just so many questions I have here. May I just ask you to articulate then this profound difference that exists in what's possible for a writer or anybody on a given day, depending on the attitude that they take? You know, what's happening in a person's mind and brain when, for example, they sit down and say, oh, this is so hard, I feel as if all I'm writing is rubbish, as opposed to sitting in front of their page and saying, oh, what a wonderful opportunity, I wonder what I'm going to find out today. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, you know, it's very interesting. I think that, you know, I think there's an integrative process that involves the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, that involves the cortex, the limbic area, and the brainstem. So in other words, side-to-side integration, honoring differences, promoting linkages of the left and the right, up and down integration. At the higher part of the brain is the cortex, midline is the limbic area, down below in the head at least is the brainstem, and then down below even further in the body is your heart and your intestine. These are all neural networks, and the processing of information that comes from a neural network can, you know, exist within its own subsystem, if you will. My intestines have their own neural net firings. My heart has its own. The stuff up in my brainstem has its own. The limbic area its own, and the cortex. That's five different areas, let alone what I'm taking in from other people's bodies. So there you see five subsystems that have their own wholeness to them, and let alone there's left and right, so that's, I guess, a sixth one. So you can, if you imagine that creativity, innovation, spontaneity, and uncertainty all arise from giving permission for new combinations out of your control, without your ability to predict, without your sense that you are in charge, to unfold. And so that's what I mean by uncertainty. That's what I mean by, you know, being creative in all the different manifestations of the C's, middle, lower, upper case C. So when you take that approach, you say, okay, so some days I'm going to be really thinking, this is what I need to do, blah, 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 blah. And this is what I'm worried the reader is going to think this way or that way. And all that stuff is a bunch of left brain stuff, super logical, linear use of language, not much in touch with the body, no flood of emotions from the brainstem and limbic area. The left brain in isolation is pretty, you know, robotic. And ironically, it is also the side of the brain that is really concerned about social display rules. You know, how am I going to appear to other people? So if you begin this process of, you know, I would call it non-integrative left brain writing. I know for myself, when I get to the editing part, or sometimes if I've written, you know, for, you know, half an hour or whatever, and I come back and I see a section and I'm ready to move on to the next section, I'll sort of put on my editor hat and say, okay, let me look at this. And I'll read it, and it's crappy. It's really lousy. And I have to have the audacity to be ruthless and say, you know something, this feels cold, it feels mechanical, it feels purpose-driven, you know, in the sense of it's trying to achieve something rather than allowing itself to unfold. And I will literally excise it from the document. I will put it, because I'm not so ruthless, I will actually put in a file called crap, you know, and I will stick it there, not in my junk thing in, you know, my wastebasket in my computer, but I will stick it in a special Word document called junk, or, you know, or lousy writing, or, you know, as if, or something, or whatever I might call it, depending on my mood, and I stick it there. And then for fun, when the whole thing has been unfolding more and more, I'll go back and look. And for the most part, because there's another file for, you know, good but misplaced, so I need to take it out of the series and stick it somewhere where I think I'll use it. And often I will find a time to use that one. It was just the wrong timing for it. But there's other stuff I'm talking about, the junk. When I read it, it is cold. It doesn't grab my attention. It bores me. It doesn't have a flow to it. It's not universal. It's disconnecting. And yet it's saying everything I intended it to say, but it says it in a way that's really, I mean, for me, as the person who typed it, painful to read. And so rather than being like, you know, vested in it or invested, maybe both, you know, I have to let go of that and say, yeah, I typed this, but it's crap and it's just no good. And it's pretty clear to me, you know, when that's the case. Now, I can write and publish something and people don't like it, you know, and that's fine, and they can think the whole thing is crap. So I'm not trying to say, oh, my writing's so good. I'm just saying that for my own process, I have to have some kind of standard of evaluating when, as you're saying, the writing doesn't work, even though I may have been, I mean, there's sometimes when I'm just not in the mood to write and nothing comes to me, and days can go by when that's the case. And I've learned to just let that be and enjoy it and say, good, I'll go do something else. And then it comes like, oh, my God, here it is. And it's almost like a cotton ball in my head. like the pressure, like a pressure, and it feels like, wow, I've got to grab like 3 or 4 hours with my typewriter, my, you know, my computer, and put my fingers on the keyboard. I don't know what's, I don't know what this cotton ball is, but it's there. And then usually, 95% of the time, something really useful, useful in the sense that it ends up staying in the book, emerges, and it almost always is preceded by that cotton ball feeling, which I think is some kind of integrative mushiness that is saying, you know, it's ready, and the cotton ball will come out.
So is, okay, because I was, I mean, I mentioned the word aha earlier, and...
That's my cotton ball,
I guess. So your cotton ball, yeah. How fascinating. And one more paradox then, I notice myself, and I know this is common, that whilst, and you've just mentioned it there, that we may, you know, set ourselves a time to write or do whatever it is that needs to be done, but in fact sometimes our most creative insights actually happen while we're washing the dishes or making a child's lunch or something, you know. So what is that about? What is what is it that's going on in our brain? How do you explain that, that it's just, it comes unbidden? It's harder to force.
I think the brain literally is sorting things out, and sometimes what it sorts through is waiting for some piece of a puzzle. I know in this brainstorm book I just wrote, it was the hardest thing to just try to write something for an adolescent and an adult to both be able to read, and constantly be putting myself in the mind of both an adolescent and an adult at the same time. But it was really, really hard in general. But a change happened, an aha thing like you're describing happened when I came across the science of the adolescent brain's, you know, implications, that the essence of it was actually the essence of what you need as an adult to grow well throughout your adult life. And then I figured out that I could change some of the terms around that I had been writing about, and it spelled the word essence. You know, emotional spark, ES, and social engagement, SE, novelty, and creative exploration was CE. And this essence became like an aha moment, and the rest of the book kind of unfolded really in that kind of, you know, just like flooded out in this.
So that's
really,
that self-organizing thing again, isn't it?
Yeah, it was self-organizing. Yeah. But without the essence acronym and without the awareness that the remodeling adolescent brain created the fundamental pillars of a healthy adult life, it was all just like, where am I going with this book? What is this about? What is it? You know, and I used to say, you know, to my wife, I said, I'm going to cancel the contract. This book is going nowhere. It's just gobbledygook. I'm not really capable of writing this. There's no book that's ever been written for both adults and adolescents. So I know why. This is just not worth it. Let me cut it out. Let's go to the contract and see what's the escape clause, you know, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, but then once the essence became clear as I was playing around with the writing, then it was like, oh, my God, this is really fun.
I noticed that it's just hit the bestseller list.
It's been now four weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. I've never had a book that did that. And I've never really had a book that I was going to cancel the contract in my own mind, you know. So, I mean, that's funny. I mean, that should give hope to anybody who's, you know, feeling despair.
Yeah,
I mean, I had so much despair about this book. That's weird when you get that New York Times best-selling thing, because, you know, it actually made me feel bad for the other books, and I didn't want to get too excited about it because I felt like they never got anything like that. And they, like the other kids in the house, you know, I don't want to pay too much attention to this one. So my best buddy, the writer, you know, he had a long talk with me. He said, you know, this book achieved what it did because the other ones, and you're not insulting the other ones by feeling joyful about
differentiation.
This. He knows I'm kind of nuts. You know, he's known me since I was a young adolescent. So,
oh, how fascinating! One thing, just circling back now to an earlier part of the conversation, Dan, where you were talking about that relational aspect of writing that you hold, you know, so that the consideration you have as you're writing for the people who will read your work.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine that holding the audience or, you know, that external user or evaluator in mind is something that may work differently depending on the sense of self that you have. So for a person who maybe has a shakier sense of self and of confidence, that external review or readership may almost be paralyzing. You know, so there's that urge to express, but then a sort of really deep fear of exposure and a negative evaluation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That can be a huge inhibitor, I think, of embracing uncertainty. And you know, in the end, I think that point you're raising right now is the thing that really gets in a lot of people's way, is to worry too much about the outcome and get lost in that rather than, just let the process unfold. I mean, I remember when I wrote a book called The Pocket Guide to Interpersonal Neurobiology, which is an academic book, but I sat in this cafe in Paris. I was all by myself for a week, and I don't usually like to be by myself, but there I was, just the circumstances of where my daughter went, my wife went, and anyway, it's not, I can't complain, I was in Paris, but, you know, I had this job to start this book, and so I sat in this cafe, I got a nice meal, and I sat with this journal, and I said, I said to myself, have got to stop worrying about whether this book is going to be accepted by your peers, because this is from an academic book for my professional colleagues, and you've just got to let this book find its own voice. And what are you trying to do? And I said, and I'm writing this in this journal, I said, I'm trying to make the process of reading the book be parallel to the content of the book, which is about the mind and the brain and relationships. And so I said, so you've got to, since this is all nonlinear, you've got to write a nonlinear book.
Mm.
And I said to myself, what? What is that? And I'm writing this out. So I had to like get out of my own way, because I said, the editor in me, which was thinking about, people are going to think this is really stupid. There's no, what do you mean? A book is from beginning to end. What are you talking about? So I just said, okay, all right, if that's your idea, you want the process to be like the content, it sounds pretty goofy. You'll be laughed off the, whatever. How would you do it? And then I still have this journal. So I started mapping out how I would make this nonlinear book. And it turned out in that Paris cafe was exactly what I ended up doing with the Pocket Guide to Interpersonal Neurobiology, which, lots of people bought instantly of my profession, my colleagues, because it's exactly what a professional needs to take ideas and see how they're related to other ideas. I don't think it's anything anyone else would want to read, but a professional who wants to tie everything together and make it really accessible and integrate in their own life, it was just the thing. So, it was. But I remember when I was worried about what the outcome would be, it just shut me down. I said, forget it. I got to let not just the content of this book, I got to let the form of this book find its own voice. So, yeah.
Look, such a delight and privilege and pleasure to speak to you today. Thank you so much, Dr. Dan.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much.